Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello. Now, we need to start by addressing a little political rumour this week.
Yes.
So I think this started, I don't know if it was in the New Statesman's political gossip or somewhere.
Yes.
And it started to spread elsewhere. But there is a rumour that Ed is considering a return to front bench politics. And we've had an amount of email, by which I mean an email, from listeners saying, does this mean the end of the podcast? And we just want to quash this rumour straight away. I mean, what's happened?
It was news to me. I must say, yeah. This rumour was really news to me. I'm sort of carrying on doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, there's been a misunderstanding. It's me that is considering...
Yes.
From
yes.
bench politics.
Nobody's, but I wanted to keep it quiet.
Yeah, no one's considering
me. Somebody's got the wrong end of the stick.
Yeah.
No, but I think it is true, isn't it, that you're being... You're being thought about as part of heading up a government of national unity.
The Jeffocracy
could
become a reality.
Exactly, exactly.
So, you know...
We're staying together.
Yes.
Yeah.
There are no cracks in this relationship.
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
Definitely not.
So, good, that's addressed.
Yes.
And we
no need for a withdrawal agreement.
No. Because those always go so well, don't they?
Exactly.
Yeah. So we've got a lot to get through this week.
Yes.
There's lots on the podcast. So we should start by telling you what our theme is.
Yes, and we're talking about something which is quite serious, which is the death penalty and efforts to abolish it in various countries. There's been news in the last week that Malaysia, which has kind of got a lot of people, more than 1,000 people on death row, is going to abolish the death penalty. We're going to be talking to somebody from Malaysia about how that has come about. And then we'll be talking to two people from Reprieve, which is an organization that campaigns in the UK and elsewhere against death penalty. It's run by somebody who used to work for me and a yearly part of the long line of ex-employees who've gone on to better things. She's going to be talking about their work in other countries to abolish the death penalty. And I promise you, there are reasons to be cheerful.
Yeah, it sounds a bit grim,
yep.
But if you
yep.
think about the way this has moved
yep.
In recent...
It's part of progress in a world that feels like things are going backwards.
Beautifully put. And as well as that, we're going to be joined by comedian Lauren Pattison, who's going to be pitching us some ideas.
What's your reason to be cheerful?
Just a little one from me this week.
Yes.
I have managed to acquire tickets to go and see Jerry Seinfeld next year.
Wow.
Which is, you know, one of my favourite comedians. I love that sitcom.
Yes.
It's my favourite sitcom of all time. I love his web series that he does, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. And I just think he is a stand-up master. He is so precise. So I'm very much looking forward to that. I've got two tickets. And you never know, Ed.
Whoa.
If you know,
you've invited George Ezra, but if he can't make it.
At the moment, it's a two-way runoff between you and my wife. So
No.
It's whoever curries my favour the most.
She's got to win, I think.
We'll see.
She's got to win. Maybe you'll invite me to the Leisure Centre as a second prize.
Let it go. What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is something which is sort of anniversary-ish, which is that this week... It's 10 years since the Climate Change Act was passed by the House of Commons and came into force. The Climate Change Act was something which was introduced by my brother, completed its passage under me when I was the Climate Change Secretary. It is generally seen as sort of world leading because it committed Britain by law to cut its carbon emissions by 80%, with an independent body giving advice to government about how it could meet these targets. It's been emulated in different countries around the world in different ways. And I'm not doing it simply as a humble brag, although maybe that's a little bit of it. I'm more doing it because I think there's two things. One, partly because of the Climate Change Act, we have made progress as a country. So emissions in the UK are back to the levels they're at in 1890, which is good. But also, we need renewed momentum in this because, if we're honest, climate has really slipped down the political agenda for all kinds of reasons. And I think it is really, really important that we ramp up the agenda on this. I can't help thinking that the key to this is making sort of economic and social justice part of environmental justice. So not just making it about, don't we need to save the planet, but don't we need to make society fairer and better at the same time as saving the planet? I think that's, in a way, one of the things that's been a little bit missing from some of the campaigning.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're joined now by Sivan Dorisamy, Executive Director of Suaram, a leading human rights organisation in Malaysia. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us, first of all, what's the history of the death penalty in Malaysia?
In Malaysia, death penalty has always been the facet of the criminal justice system in Malaysia. The penal code which Malaysia imported from India, which was introduced by the British during the colonial era, was maintained throughout the years and extended to the security offences within the country. So in general, death penalty is often associated with the four offences: murder, firearm-related, drug trafficking and kidnapping, which led to death. And at the moment, there are at least 1,279 inmates on death row, with most of them on the death row for drug offences, around 932. So the next largest majority of the death row inmate would be death row for murder.
And I think I'm right in saying that it was mandatory for certain offences up to now in Malaysia, yeah?
That's right, yeah. So death sentence is always mandatory, especially for these for murder, firearms related, and also drug trafficking and kidnapping, which led to death. So this is mandatory death sentence.
And now we've got to the situation where the government of Mr. Mahathir, recently elected, has said it's going to abolish the death penalty. Tell us how this has come about.
Abolishing capital punishment, there's always an ongoing campaign in Malaysia, especially from the civil society. But now, after the government change, Mahathir's political allies, there's many of them were previously from the opposition, and some of them are worked with us on the campaign against death penalty. So now they are with the government, with the Mahathir's cabinet. They still hold on to the aspiration and advocating for both in parliament and in cabinet to abolish death penalty. I think so. That's the change, how it happened, and it's everything come into places now.
Does it need legislation to go through parliament to make the abolition happen?
Yes, that's right. So that's the ongoing campaign. So probably this will be tabled next parliament sitting, and there is issues and campaigns already in the public for the abolishment of the death penalty.
And what is it that has brought the campaign to this point of the government committing to the abolition of the death penalty, even though the legislation has still got to get through? How do you think this has come about, apart from having these opposition parties part of it? What has had the biggest impact with the public?
Okay, first, how the government came, the idea of abolishment is already there with the previous government, but we couldn't see much of the political will. Sometimes they say they're going to table in the parliament and then they backtrack a few times. So this been ongoing, and then after some time they said, okay, let's start with the drug offenders, drug-related cases. So probably there will be a discretionary power rather than mandatory death sentence for the drug offenders, drug-related offences. But after the change of government, again, those in the cabinet now, those with the new government, are also people who've been campaigning against death sentences before. So they were together with the civil society. They were advocating on campaigns. So now they are with the government. So it made much easier for them to push forward the already on the table of abolishing death penalty. So that made it easier. So now it's already in the parliament. They already start talking about the abolishing death penalty. The prime minister has promised this death penalty will go. But the public sentiment on the death penalty need to be tackled. So this is very important again. There is a need to be a holistic engagement with the members of public to ensure that the people understand the concern on death penalty and why it needs to go. This cannot be mere death penalty is unjust and thus must be done with. It's too straightforward for them to accept and understand. But it must be a holistic discussion on how restorative justice serves better than a retributive justice and enlighten them, the public, on how there are alternatives. And second is a bipartisan support for the death penalty would likely be present in the most countries who still maintaining the death penalty. The government of the day should not seek to hog all the glory in abolishing death penalty and suffer political backlash when the move is seen as bipartisan. So bipartisan support would strengthen the move for abolishment and would more effectively reach out to the general public and internationalize understanding of the reasons for abolishing death penalties.
When you talk about public sentiment, how far off are the public on this? If you look at percentages in polling, what percentage of the public are opposed to the death penalty?
I think it's like still 50-50, but it's also sometimes when you have cases, like one of the recent cases is like rape of a child, and then the baby died. So this guy is supposed to be the guardian, and he raped the baby, and the baby died. And then now everyone thinking like, okay, you need to exception some cases, you really need impose death penalty. So now, if you do the survey now, probably there will be imbalance in terms of for the death penalty and against the death penalty.
As an experienced campaigner on this, what is the argument that has been most effective at persuading the public that Malaysia should abolish the death penalty?
So the biggest argument is you put forward some cases which there is a new evidence led to clear his case. But once you already impose the death sentence, you can't reverse it. So that's what another argument that people said, okay, yeah, that makes sense. You know, sometimes there's not enough evidences, but then you already sentenced them to death. Like a few, one or two cases in Singapore. And then sometimes then you have a better evidence or new evidence, you know, with the technology, then you find out, okay, so there's no clear case. But you can't reverse the decision anymore. The other issue for Malaysia in terms of death sentences, okay, we have down south, Singapore is a neighboring country. So they've been like using death sentences in many cases, especially drug-related cases. And then in some cases, the offenders are not Singaporean, they are from Malaysia. So they traffic the drug and then they got hanged in Singapore. But the same argument, this is a universal call. So we hope few countries in this region will follow suit once Malaysia have abolished this capital punishment. So there are countries like Singapore, Indonesia, Laos probably will follow because it's a global trend. Many countries are slowly abolishing capital punishment. So that's the big hope.
Sivan Dorisamy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
We're delighted to be joined by Maya Foa and Anna Yearley from Reprieve. Hello.
Hello.
Now, before we get started, Anna, you used to work for ED, but you decided to do something a bit easier, so working to abolish the death penalty globally. That must be less challenging than
exactly.
working with him.
I think it's quite telling that I left working for ED to try and end the death penalty and shut Guantanamo Bay, and that somehow I thought that would be more fun and a little bit easier.
You're part of a sort of long line of people who have gone on to great and successful things since leaving working for me.
Yes, a long line of people, but the last person to be invited on the podcast. Yeah, I know. I actually first met Ed quite a lot before I started working for him, and I went up to help him.
You're not going to mention
office.
The brown suit, are you?
I have got pictures of that brown suit, which is basically my retirement fund.
Yeah.
It was a brown corduroy suit. I think we've still
got
it.
It's
amazing. It's amazing. So I went up to help Ed set up his constituency
you
office.
Did?
I did. I came up to Doncaster and spent 2 weeks seeing the sights of Donny. And I remember you took me to the Greyhound racing.
Yes.
Do you remember that? And that is when I first saw Ed dance. And we had a little buffet and we had a disco, do you remember? And we put on, I think, what was it called? Living on a Prayer by Bon
yes.
Jovi,
your favourite
song.
How did I do?
I think that was when I realised that you needed to be Prime Minister. I thought seeing you dance was the moment I thought this man has to be inflicted on the country.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why not?
Well, I mean, I'd like to see. I've heard him sing karaoke, but I'm.
It's basically about the level he sings karaoke.
Right, okay.
It's kind of a similar.
Relatively low, I would
yeah,
say.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So we should probably start by talking about Reprieve for people who don't know about the work you do. Can you tell us a little about it?
Yeah, Reprieve is a legal organisation and we work on the death penalty globally, and we also work on abuses in counterterrorism like Guantanamo Bay, assassinations, drone attacks, that sort of thing. And we were
really cheery.
We're founded by Clive Stafford-Smith nearly 30 years
20
ago.
Years
20
ago.
Years ago. 20 years ago. I mean, time flies when you're having fun, guys. It's really 20 years ago. And Anna joined us three years ago.
And they wanted someone with a sense of humour.
Wanted someone with a sense of humour. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Lighten the mood a bit. No, we have lots of fun in the office, but we do lots of very serious work as well.
And just, I think lots of our listeners will have this position, but it's kind of, some may not, and it's worth setting it out. Why is the death penalty a bad thing?
So for me, actually, this is really interesting. When I came for my interview at Reprieve, because Reprieve has quite a sort of non-hierarchical structure, I was interviewed by the people I would be managing. That was a kind of key part of my interview. And Maya asked me this question, actually. She said to me, why do you think the death penalty is wrong? And there's this amazing lawyer in America called Brian Stevenson, and he founded an organization called the Equal Justice Initiative, and they do a lot of work around the racial bias of the US justice system. And I saw him on YouTube, and he's got this amazing quote, which is, each of us is better than the worst thing we've ever done. And I think about that all the time. And if you think, it's a similar quote to Sister Helen Prejean, who's the amazing Catholic nun in the States who campaigns against the death penalty. And she was the inspiration for the film Dead Man Walking. And she always talks about you being the better than the worst 15 minutes of your life. And I think about that a lot. I mean, the worst 15 minutes of your life, Ed, I think probably were when you ate that bacon sandwich.
I mean, the dancing sounds pretty bad.
The dancing was pretty bad, but on reflection, I think the bacon sandwich was probably the worst.
Thanks.
But when I go into that. I know, I thought we needed to mention it.
Exactly. We're back to the death penalty.
And so for me, I just think if we say to people that killing people is wrong, which of course it is, and then our solution to that is we're going to kill you for showing that killing people is wrong, it just seems crazy. It just seems such a stupid argument.
I completely agree. And one of the things that's so striking when you look at the death penalty in America, which likes to think that it has a very enlightened justice system, and then you look at the death penalty in Malawi or in Pakistan or in Indonesia, and you know, all around the world, it's always politically motivated. Mm-hmm. It is always those without the capital who get the punishment, so to speak. So the people who are the most impoverished, or the people who are the most disenfranchised, or the people who are the most vilified in society, which means that it can then be used as a tool to oppress a whole society. So, you know, it's no surprise that we have this big war on drugs, and then suddenly now we have hundreds of people being executed for basic drug addiction, if they even did anything at all, in lots of countries in the world. We now have the war on terror, and that's being used to justify executions of teenagers in Saudi Arabia who attended protests. It's just such a slippery slope. So even if you think in certain circumstances it might be justified, the ramifications of having a policy that allows us to kill people for the worst 15 minutes of their lives. So, for example, that dance, you know, that's problematic. I mean, some might not say that. But, you know, you can see the extension.
Before we get onto the specific work that Reprieve is doing, give us the global picture on this. Because I think I'm right in saying there are some very bad things happening, but it is getting better, the global picture.
Absolutely. Every year, more states abolish the death penalty, either in law or in practice, and I'm talking globally. And then in specific countries, we're on the brink of abolition in a number of countries. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that, you know, when you tell people that you work on the death penalty, people think it's very depressing, but it's actually not. Because if you win more than you lose and you're dealing with saving lives, then that means, you have an amazing job. You get to save lives every day. And we're definitely moving in the right direction. I think this will be a relic of the past.
And this is one of the questions that we were exploring earlier with our guest from Malaysia, Sivan. Why is it happening? Is it the campaigners? Is it recognition about miscarriages of justice? Is it we're becoming a more humane world, which doesn't seem like that in lots of ways? What do you think?
I think it's a combination of factors, but it doesn't work, right? So anybody who is pro-death penalty, I sort of challenge them to say, give me a really good reason for it, because it doesn't provide a deterrent effect. It doesn't stop people committing crimes. And it also is costly, not just in terms of the expense on the system, but innocent lives and society. So I think as those harms in each country get as we're able to shine a spotlight on those particular problems in the particular context of the country, people turn away from it because it doesn't make sense. It does make sense politically. It's a cheap, easy political fix. But if it becomes more expensive, more difficult, and something of a political nightmare, which is our job all the time, is to get in the way of that, easy solution, then I think people will turn away. And that's what we see.
We'll get onto some specifics in a sec. But what's the sort of tools you use to... Is it different in different countries? Is it using sort of popular support? What's the ways of doing it?
Definitely different in different countries. But our sort of underlying philosophy is always we have sort of two courts that we're working in. So we've got the court of law, and we can use that in some countries where there is a proper justice system. And we also have the court of public opinion. And we kind of view those equally important, I think it's fair to say, because if you can't take people with you and persuade them, then you're not going to be able to affect the change that you want. And it's certainly true in some countries. Saudi Arabia is a really good example. The court of law is kind of next to useless. So what we have to use, and public
for
opinion,
an external organization.
Exactly. So what we are able to use in somewhere like Saudi Arabia is public opinion outside of Saudi Arabia. So in the UK or in America or in other European countries.
And in the time that you've been at Ripper, which is about two...
Just nearly 3 years.
I know. Time flies when you're missing me. What's the thing you're proudest of, would you say?
I would say... it's probably Andy Sege being released from death row in Ethiopia. So he is a British Ethiopian man who has lived in Britain for about 30 years, lived in London with his wife Yemi and their three children. And Andy was a political activist in Ethiopia, and that's why he'd come to this country, because it was unsafe for him to stay there. And he was given a death sentence in absentia, so basically in his absence, which is illegal under international law. And Andy was kidnapped from an international airport, and he was rendered and taken back to Ethiopia, where he was held
for political activism.
Basically. And he was held for quite a while without actually his family even knowing where he was. I think they thought he was stuck at the airport. They were trying to get hold of him. And he was held for nearly 4 years on death row. And actually, it was his amazing wife, Yemi, who wasn't his wife at the time, but they just got married after he was released. Yemi came to our office to see Maya and to see the team and to say, look, can I get your help? And Maya, of course, said, yes, absolutely, we're going to help. And so we, over the last 4 years, ran a series of really amazing campaigns, both in Parliament, but also externally. We did huge amount of public advocacy on his case. And then in May this year, we got a phone call from Yemi to say, she just had a phone call from a journalist in Ethiopia to say Andy was being released that weekend.
How did it end up happening?
I think partly, and Maya, correct me if this is wrong, I think partly the political change within Ethiopia, that is definitely true. But also, I think for me, it just is a great example of where you don't give up hope, and you make sure that this world's kind of attention is focused on somebody.
And so Ethiopia wanted better relations with other countries, partly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was keeping it as a political issue. Our strategy, if we can't get into the country, we need to find another lever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Ethiopia, this is a British citizen, like any one of us,
yeah,
who was sentenced to death,
yeah,
for writing a book called, right, Freedom Fighters Who Don't Know What Freedom Is. He's living in London, North London, near here. He gets kidnapped from an airport, rendered to Ethiopia, where he's sitting on death row. And we needed the British government to do more. So we continued to, mm-hmm, push the case publicly, politically, legally, as far as we could, and in lots of different fora. Because of that, he wasn't forgotten. And because of that, when there was the opportunity for political change within Ethiopia, the Prime Minister made Andy's case,
yeah,
you know, a key case on which he either took up his position or didn't. He said, Andy needs to be released or I do not do X, Y, Z. I mean, it was amazing.
So he's the Prime Minister of
Ethiopia.
Right.
So now Andy's role, because, you know, he was always politically active, but there's this international acknowledgement of his status in Ethiopia and outside. And he has this potential to do so much good from having been put through such awful torment. I think that's pretty fascinating and amazing. And that's a case that it was not easy to take on, you know. It was a case where they said, he's a terrorist. This wasn't terrorism. This was a man who had written about the Ethiopian political parties as they were formed at the time. And they didn't like it. So we have to be really, really careful about how we react when that bogeyman word is used,
yeah,
because the British government were hands off to start with. They said, well, you know, there's nothing we can do. He's been sentenced to death by a court. We'll maybe try and get consular access. That's not okay.
We're speaking the week when Matthew Hedges has been sentenced to life in prison in the UAE, and people may have heard his wife talking about his case, and it has raised the issue of the activism or otherwise of the UK government. What is your general experience on this? Is it different in different countries depending on our commercial interests?
We're going to be really polite now.
Right. Oh, shit.
Maybe not so much, actually. Maybe we won't be that polite.
It is different, it is depending different. On our relationship. There are lots of areas where we think they could be doing more. You know, we have a principled opposition to the death penalty. I think of late there have been a couple of instances where we might have wavered on that principled, yeah, uncategorical, or categorical rather, opposition.
So this is Sajid Javid in relation, yeah, to the extradition, exactly, to the US.
Yeah.
But also, even in yeah, Andy's case, the former foreign secretary refused to call for his
Boris
release.
Johnson.
Yeah, well, no one called for his release publicly.
In the government, politicians would, you know, individual members of parliament from all political parties, they would. But, and I do feel that there has been a shift actually with the new foreign secretary. He has been more vocal, obviously, around the case of Matthew in the UAE, but also Nazanin in Iran. These are not cases that we work on because they don't, they're not facing the death penalty. But he definitely has been more vocal in saying governments need to act. And I think that feels to me to be a really positive change.
And it does make a difference. You know, right, that question of where the noise comes,
yes,
from. The British government has a right to advocate on behalf of their nationals and also a principled opposition.
And the European Union plays an important role,
absolutely,
in this too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they fund campaigns, yeah, and they, mm-hmm, do advocacy, mm-hmm, work.
Yeah, they do a huge amount of work about global abolition of the death penalty. Yeah, and they fund a lot of organisations.
Talk to us about America, because this is obviously a big focus of your work. It's one of the places where I think I'm right in saying that fewer and fewer states are at least implementing the death penalty.
Mm. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what you've been doing there.
Well, it's a really fascinating moment in the US right now. We do some casework on individuals, but we also look at the method of execution, and they use the lethal injection primarily, although that's now changing in the US. And what's really fascinating about that is it was brought in as this softer, gentler, more humane, and I'm using inverted commas, way of killing. And actually the reality is it's absolutely would be torture. You get traditionally a 3-drug cocktail of drugs. The first one's meant to put you to sleep, but if it doesn't, the second one paralyzes you. That's purely cosmetic, so that we, the spectators, the public, don't have to see any suffering. It doesn't serve a medical function. And then the third drug is just this extremely powerful, potent substance that acts like fire in the blood. And one of the Supreme Court justices said it's the chemical equivalent of being burnt alive at the stake from the inside. And so this method, which has been used for years and years and years and years, they started to have trouble in 2010 getting the drugs. And what happened, and this is where it came in and Reprieve started working on the case, some of the states somehow discovered a supplier working out of a driving school, the back room of a driving school in West London.
In Acton,
West London. It's called Dream Pharma. And
such a great name.
I know, right? So, you know, we discovered this and started investigating the supply chain and found that this guy had sold execution drugs enough to kill hundreds of prisoners to states across the US. They were not FDA approved, which means they shouldn't have been allowed into the US in the first place. It did result in some what we call botched executions.
And US drug companies were not at that point.
At that point, there were some difficulties with manufacturing, right, one, right, particular drug. So that's why the states, right, came to the UK. They
came to Acton.
To Dream Pharma. There were these funny disclosures. Now they give me less and less, but at one point we used to get reams of documents where they would have email exchanges between corrections officials, so prison officials. And there were some of these Dream Pharma drugs from Acton. Once we shut them off, we sort of brought a judicial review to get an export control in place. The government put an export control in place because, you know, Britain doesn't support the death penalty by way of providing the drugs for executions. So we won that one. They cut off the supplies. And then you see this scramble in the US where they're all looking for the drug, the Dream Pharma drugs. And some officials in California travel to Arizona, and Arizona officials lend them some drugs. And they travel back and they document it all because they're trying to prove they've kept chain of custody. And when they get back to California, they write to the folks in Arizona and alongside saying, you know, I'll buy you a beer, they say, you guys in AZ are real lifesavers.
Oh, my God.
No irony. Because they provided them with the drugs that they needed to start killing people. They still haven't started killing people. And the positive side of this is that, you know, I saw all that happening and traced the supplies and discovered that the companies who make the drugs, which had ended up via Dream Pharma in the hands of all these executioners, really didn't want their drugs used in executions. They make them, you know, you can imagine the tagline, we save and improve the lives and health of patients.
So basically corporate reputation became a tool to really reduce the use of the death penalty in the US. And it has worked.
It has, yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that we've seen, so all of the companies that make execution drugs, which are, of course, medicines, being misused in execution chambers, they all oppose the misuse of their medicines. There's now like 50 companies. They've all put controls in place to stop prisons buying the drug. And that's had the impact, of course, cutting off supplies in a number of states. And some states have stopped executing altogether, a majority, actually. Other states are fighting legal challenges over new protocols. And some states, including the state that invented the lethal injection, have now rejected it altogether. And they've rejected on the grounds that they say, one, they can't get the drugs legally, but two, the lethal injection is inhumane. The state that invented the lethal injection said Oklahoma,
right,
that they've seen executions in other states by lethal injection. They're not reflecting on themselves, of course. And that looks inhumane. Now, that's really significant because it's the debunking of the myth of the humane medical execution.
Have you got the figures on this as to what the give us the sort of headlines about what's happened in the US?
Lowest number of executions in the last quarter of a century, over the last few years. Over half the stays are because of stays of execution are because of lethal injection challenges. Only a handful of states are really executing now. And that's a lot of that's to do with drug problems. And a lot of it is to do with really, really, really good lawyers defending their clients who, I go back to that first point, these are not the worst of the worst necessarily. These are the people who had the worst of the worst lawyers at trial.
Yeah.
They're the people who get the death penalty. So if we have good lawyers and if they're able to bring the facts to court and if they have time to investigate, then very often death sentences get
overturned. And is public opinion changing in America?
It is changing. That's certainly the case.
And it's certainly changing, isn't it, in states where they then don't use the death penalty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really interesting because somebody said to me, a doctor actually, who used to be pro-death penalty, and then he learned about the lethal injection and became anti-death penalty, which is an unusual route in. But he said, you know, I grew up in a state where executions were happening. And if they're happening, you think you need them. It's a bit like any rule that we have in this country. If it's there, you sort of think, well, if it weren't there, maybe we'd all fall into anarchy. So if you can show a period of time with no executions and actually crime rates don't go up and actually murder rates maybe go down, then that's very persuasive, I think, emotionally for people. I don't think it's you know, I don't think it's odd that people who've lived in a state where capital punishment exists think that that's necessary. And that maybe takes us back to what we in Britain and other countries that don't have the death penalty can do to say, oh, no, by the way, guys, you know, the sky doesn't fall down. And actually, we have a lower crime rate or a lower homicide, serious crime rate in Britain than we do in America. And indeed, in America, the states with the death penalty have a higher murder rate than the states without. So,
And what was your role in highlighting this to the drugs companies involved?
Well, some of the companies didn't know. When states started to use new drugs, the companies, they didn't make those drugs for use in lethal injection. So the first drug, pentobarbital, was manufactured by a company called Lundbeck. I spoke with the company. They had absolutely no idea that this was happening, and they were horrified by it. That is absolutely the case. They are all horrified at the idea of their drugs used to torture and kill people.
It's a Scandinavian company.
It happens to be, it's in Denmark. So I spent some time with the company and some time learning how distribution controls work. It sounds very geeky, but I am very geeky, as Anna will tell you. So I spent many, many nights talking to people, trying to design what would be the perfect distribution controls. The company did not immediately respond to my saying, well, you need to do something about this. And no company had ever done this before. They'd never implemented distribution control. So it's sort of understandable. I, at the time, decided that that was not understandable and that I would persuade them. And one of the things that I did was to show that the lethal injection really is inhumane. We did a press conference in Denmark at which I brought a lizard. And
a
the
lizard.
Yeah, I had a lizard on the table. I had a background
in
theatre. No, I have a background in theatre. I had very,
how did you
I had lots of
the
props,
lizard?
Friends. They
the
managed
lizard.
To get.
It didn't come from Acton or anything.
No, I did not transport it over. Yeah. But what I was saying was that it would be illegal to do to the lizard what you are
right.
legally obliged to do to a prisoner in the state of Texas when you execute them. You know, using that paralytic drug that I mentioned, that is torture. And the American Veterinary Medical Association says you can't right. do it when you euthanize animals. So for anyone who says, well, isn't it just the same as putting your dog down? No, you absolutely wouldn't be allowed to do that. And interestingly, you know, Lundbeck, when I described the distribution controls, the CEO, in fact, who I was sitting opposite, said, why don't we do that? We should do that.
Are you sure it just wasn't that he wanted to get rid of you and the lizard?
The comms director said to me, we had a lovely lunch and all of this was sort of sorted and we had publicly announced that they'd put the controls in place. And the comms person took me aside and said, you know, all of this was great. Really enjoyed working with you. The controls are amazing. Why did you have to bring the lizard, though? He was really upset by the lizard.
You know, most of our listeners are here in the UK. If they're listening to these stories and feeling inspired by them, are there things that people can do to support the work that you do and that support the campaigns to abolish the death penalty worldwide?
There definitely are. That's a great question. So we have a very fantastic website, reprieve.org.uk. And on there, we will run a huge amount of petition campaigns. And they might sound a bit, oh, okay, yeah, sign a petition. But actually, they definitely make a difference. And then going back to the thing I talked about earlier on Saudi Arabia, where it's very hard for us in Britain to do anything sort of legally in the country, what we can do is get people to put pressure. And so we earlier this year delivered a petition to the Saudi embassy. They wouldn't take it. Maya went with Bianca Jagger and they refused to take the petition, but had 100,000 people had signed a petition to call for Saudi Arabia to not execute young people. So we've identified 18 young men now, but they were boys and teenagers when they were sentenced to death, many of whom were sentenced to death for their political activism. One of them was sentenced to death because he'd administered a Facebook group. So this is, you know, pretty horrific. He was actually on his way to the airport where he was going to go and take up a place at a university in America on a sports scholarship. He was 17 years old, Mushaba, and he was arrested on his way to the airport. And it is, I firmly believe, because of the work of Reprieve and other human rights organisations, that those boys are still alive in Saudi Arabia, because we have shown people in Saudi Arabia that we are watching and that the UK government and other governments are not going to let this happen. And so signing petitions, writing to your Member of Parliament, I know MPs get shed loads of letters from people all the time, but actually saying to your MP, you've got to raise this, you've got to stop these executions from happening. The British government does have influence in Saudi Arabia and in many of the other countries where we work, particularly in the Middle East. And so what people can do is go to our website, look at our campaign, sign our petitions. But also the other thing that we do quite a bit of is when we've got people who are in prison facing death sentences, is we will send them a birthday card. On their birthday, we will get thousands of people to send them a birthday card. And I know some people think, oh, it's a bit naff, it's not going to work. But actually, last year, we helped secure the release of a young Irish man called Ibrahim Halawa. And Ibrahim was 17 when he was arrested in Egypt. He was on holiday visiting family and he was rounded up on a protest in Cairo. And he spent nearly 4 years, I think, facing a death sentence. And we sent him a letter, a card signed by 15,000 people for his 21st birthday. And we didn't know if he got it or not. And last year he was released and he came into our office to thank us. And he said, the thing that gave me hope when I had lost hope That's was brilliant. Opening your birthday card. That was amazing. I mean, we were all sort of slightly influenced to tears at that point, but that was incredible. And he said the Irish consul gave it to him. And they said, well, we're going to have to take it away, but you can have a look at it and you can see. And he read these messages. And he said, at that point, I was on the brink of giving up. And I do think those things can make a difference to the individuals, but absolutely make a difference to the cases.
And we've got one other question, which is we have this thing on the podcast called the Jeffocracy, which is Jeff as the sort of benign dictator.
Nice.
He definitely is not going to have the death penalty.
No.
let's say he appoints you as his sort of death penalty envoys or anti-death penalty envoys, but better put.
Would you be the dancing envoy?
I'm going to be his sort of advisor.
I've never said that.
I'm applying for the job as his advisor. What's the thing you would do? What's the thing you'd be telling him to do? What's the thing you'd be
support
doing?
Reprieve?
Yeah, no, indeed. But in just maybe partly on the subject of British influence and, you know, the British government, you're controlling the British. I mean, I know it's a scary thought, although not as scary as the current situation, that Jeff controls the British government. But what more could be being done?
I would say, look, the British government have enormous influence around the world, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but they do. And I think the British government should stand by their principles. So if we have a principle of being opposed to the death penalty, which we've had in this country since it was abolished in the 1960s, then we need to stand behind that. And if that is saying to other countries where they are using the death penalty as a form of repression and a political tool, then we need to tell people that that's wrong. And I don't think there's anything colonial or wrong about saying that. I think that's using our influence for good.
And it does work.
Yeah, it absolutely does work. Like the case I said in Saudi Arabia or certainly in other countries, it does work. And it doesn't work in every country, that is fair to say. And you have to do that kind of country by country. But I think the British government should absolutely stand by its principles. And when British citizens are facing terrible situations overseas, whether that was the case of Andy in Ethiopia or Matthew in UAE or Nazanin in Iran, it's absolutely right that the British government say it's wrong that British citizens are treated like this.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it's also supporting the organisations on the ground. You know, that's what we try to do all the time is partner up, because you can understand the situation on the ground and change it by mm-hmm. working with the people who are experiencing it. And they need that external support. It's not a colonial thing. It's actually, you know, if we can boost the case of a guy and a kid in Saudi Arabia who was dragged from his bed and, you know, brutally tortured and sentenced to crucifixion, we should be doing that. And you know, people in positions of power in government, like Jeff, should be helping.
I like Jeff.
I'm in.
I'm in. We're in. Myra and Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Hello,
it's me.
Hi.
We forgot to do the bit on this week's podcast where after the discussion we kind of summarise it and say what we thought.
Is this where we pretend that we're doing a call where we've just worked it out?
I think so, because I think it would sound strange if we just recorded it and didn't acknowledge the fact that you're on the phone.
I think we've got to break down the fourth wall.
Yes.
And we've got to admit to the fact that we found out 3 days ago.
We don't want to patronise them.
It works, and I think those things where it's like bring,
yeah.
You know, hello,
yes.
Oh, we forgot to, it's just a bit sort of passé, really.
It was going to be done with a wink to the listener, assuming that they would know it was all sort of done tongue-in-cheek.
Oh, I see. Well, should we do it all again then?
No, this is fine.
so what did you think of the episode?
Well, I mean, I'm struggling to think of, even more than usual, I'm struggling to think of anything that isn't inane, because of course the work that they're doing at Reprieve is incredible, and the fact that more and more countries are abolishing the death penalty is just a positive thing. There's no other way of looking at it, really.
I think that's right, and I think it's something about the fact that this is just, you know, this is incredibly hard work, but that they're doing, but it's sort of, it's kind of uncomplicated. I don't mean it's uncomplicated the work. I mean, it's uncomplicated in the cause. You know what I mean? Mm. The death penalty is awful and they're trying to stop it and they are making a difference. And I think the sort of message it sends is, you know, I'd really encourage people to get involved with Reprieve's campaigns or others' campaigns. But I suppose what struck me about the discussion is I thought they might be saying, look, external pressure is often counterproductive. You know, and it kind of makes people, or at least, you know, you could imagine people might think that, but it, obviously not. External pressure really makes a difference. And actually, external pressure from Britain makes a difference. So putting pressure on our politicians or in other countries is really important.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
So if you have any thoughts on what you've heard, or actually stories of campaigns that you've been involved in that have made a difference, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast. We're on Instagram too, it's the same. And on Facebook, facebook.com/reasons to be cheerful podcast. Let's have a look. This comes from J.R. Ryan, who says, hello, I was recently in conversation with former Green Party leader Natalie Bennett and another person, and they mentioned that whilst interviewing Yuval Noah Harari.
That means they listen. That's nice.
Hello, Natalie.
Yeah, hello, Natalie.
Yeah.
Shout out to Natalie.
And the other person, the unnamed person.
Yeah.
And JR. Wondered aloud why no one had created an app to identify propaganda and how it affects people. I just wanted to say that I have.
Wow.
JR continues, I'm an educator and multidisciplinary designer, and I've created a system of anti-propaganda that I call Reset Propaganda. I gave it this name because its aim is to use the common tools of persuasion and psychological manipulation found in all forms of propaganda and marketing to highlight our biases, provide alternative narratives, and show how these tools are used to manipulate us, thereby revealing methods to look out for in the future.
This one comes from Rachel Sedgwick. It's on the 3-day weekend, and she says, "Hi, I'm a bit behind the times, but I've just binged your podcasts, and I thought there were some interesting points around the 3-day weekend. When you think about it in reference to the Google model, i.e. the 4-day week model is to have staff in less often but promote more productivity. Would you create a workplace environment then with fewer collaboration zones and perks such as massages, etc.? Because that runs in entire contradiction to the way most modern, certainly within tech, companies set themselves up as places where staff stay for as long as possible, potentially all through the night, but have access to nap pods, in-house bars, internal restaurants, ping pong tables, gyms, etc. I just thought it was interesting that both these employer focuses are trying to achieve the same thing, but one encourages staff to stay for as long as possible and creates distraction, one dictating as few hours as possible with no distractions. I think it is interesting because I think Bloomberg set up in King's Cross, and I think they made a big thing that they weren't going to have in-house diddly-doos because...
in-house diddly-doos,
yeah,
you say.
Yeah. You know, because, but, you know, canteens, yes, massage, gyms, blah, because they wanted people to get out and about into the community, and they didn't necessarily want everyone to stay at work for ages.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see if there's any data on that Silicon Valley tech company model of stuffing workplaces with fun.
Tend to think maybe they want to treat their employees well, but also maybe they want to just keep them there for as long as possible.
Yeah, definitely. And this comes from Dan in Sambach, and the subject line is an apology of sorts. He says, I'm a relative newbie to the podcast phenomenon and came to your podcast via a Guardian article. And he talks a little bit about podcasts. Then he says, and now for my apology, I am a reformed mind, I feel. The subjects touched on with regards to media forcing a narrative upon its readers and whatnot really struck a chord. I feel these narratives were strong well before the referendum, even within the mainstream media, and were really coming to the fore as Ed's leadership of the Labour Party was happening. He says, I watch back Ed's speeches now, and I think what an inspirational person he is and was, and yet when I watched them at the time, my I know best mindset made it almost impossible to appreciate and empathise. Does this fill you with joy that somebody is watching your old speeches?
Yes, at least somebody is. What was it? You said banging on or something.
I don't No, I said banging on.
Droning on.
I said droning on with regards to speeches. Droning. And because of your own baggage, you thought I was talking about your speeches.
Droning on.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet @cheerfulpodcast.
And joining us with some ideas that could be potential reasons to be cheerful, comedian Lauren Pattinson. Hello.
Hello, hiya.
Hi. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
What's going on with you at the minute?
I'm doing my show that I did in Edinburgh, just here, there and everywhere. Thought I would sort it all out myself, thinking that was a really cool thing to do. And now I'm like, it's a lot of admin. I can see why normally I let someone do this for us.
And do you drive?
I don't, which makes everything just that bit harder.
Oh, God, so you're sort of coordinating trains?
A lot of trains. A lot of trains.
Right.
I feel like they need to do train points like they do air miles.
That's a great idea, actually.
Yeah. Good idea.
You do all that as well.
Yeah, good
exactly.
idea.
Because I never use air miles. I never leave the country. Train points.
What a great idea.
Definitely.
So, Lauren, you've brought in some ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful. What's your first one?
Well, first one is actually travel related. I want quiet zones and child-free zones on, like, planes, trains, automobiles.
Oh, what about the poor kids?
They can shut up and sit somewhere else.
Kiddies carriage.
I think there's nothing that stresses me out more than when I sit in the quiet coach and get my little
bit.
Let me
tell you what's more stressful than that.
Yeah.
Getting onto a plane with a baby that's making noise
and being self-conscious
about
it. For
it. Yeah.
And I was like, if they had like sort of parent and child zones, it would be more chill for the parents because they're like, my baby can make as much noise as they want.
I kind of want to pretend that I don't agree, but I sort of do really.
Not necessarily even like child, but maybe if we spin it the other way and be like parent and baby zones. So
right.
Like, what's the age? What's the age cut off? Under 5?
13.
13.
Yeah.
18.
Yeah. I hate getting on the quiet coach and someone gets on with a baby. I'm like, you know that baby ain't going to be quiet.
You go on to the quiet coach, do you?
Yeah.
I always try and avoid the quiet coach.
I love the quiet coach.
Yeah, I like the quiet coach.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And I think, because I'm like, there shouldn't be any kids there, but someone always
No chance of anyone talking
on.
To you.
Exactly.
Are you quite an introvert then?
Very introverted.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Being a stand-up comic is obviously the right thing to do.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I hate people looking at us. I don't like being centre of attention. I don't really like talking to people. So I've really picked, like, the most appropriate career path.
But I think part of being an introvert but being a performer of some kind is you're in control.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, you're doing it on your own terms,
aren't
you?
You've built your own little environment to be like, I can be this person for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And then someone comes up to you after and I'm like, the 20 minutes are over. No, I can't be that person anymore.
Maybe Coach B should be renamed the introvert coach.
Yes!
Yeah.
I mean, just like abandon this quiet sort of,
facade. Yeah.
The worst
coach
thing.
For introverts, extroverts.
Yes.
But maybe that's good that you have one coach which is an extrovert coach.
Yes.
Where I can go and like have chats with people.
Yeah.
And one introvert coach, and then you've got sort of the middle ground.
Yeah.
I think finally we've hit on the perfect version of this.
I would like get rid of first class.
Yeah.
Add an introvert coach and an extrovert coach.
I'm into it, yeah,
I'm
definitely.
On
board. Finally,
we've
been working through this for over a year. I think we've finally got there with
good.
It.
Good.
All right. What's your next idea, Lauren?
I was watching the Lego movie with my nephew.
It's very good.
You know, they have
How old is your nephew?
He's 7.
Right.
Very cute.
Do you ever travel on trains with him?
Oh, no. I'd get on the bus. I remember once getting on the bus with him when he was really little. Like, walking age. He didn't need a buggy. He's supposed to be maybe 4 or 5. And he fell asleep with his eyes open. So I was just prodding him. And I was like, Matthew... Matthew, and he's just not answering, and it was the creepiest thing I'd ever seen.
Weird.
And I just had to like carry him off the bus, and then he woke up in my arms and just like jolted, and he went, I think I fell asleep. And I was like, you did, mate. It was very weird. So like eyes wide open, like glazed over.
Have you ever seen that?
No.
Only
in like
horror films.
He's a little demon.
Yeah, is he possessed?
I think that was the first sign. My sister has birthed a demon.
Yeah.
But we were watching the Lego movie, and I love how they have Taco Tuesday, and it brings everyone together.
Okay, I confess I'm now confused.
Yeah.
Surely that is the introvert's nightmare, though.
But it's nice to have one day where everyone's like.
But would you want
every Tuesday?
Maybe like every other Tuesday. Biannual Taco Tuesday.
Would you like stay in your house and just like not go out and let other people do it?
I kind of like feeling part of something.
Oh,
so
right.
I kind of...
So that is not like Jeff.
Yeah,
no. I wish people well. I just don't want to join in.
You're happy
it.
For them to have street parties.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Not
as I've
with
said
you.
Before, I'm happy to look out the window and see everybody enjoying themselves.
Yeah.
And think, what a lovely community I live in.
So you want to bring the communities together. I think it's good.
I think we need something... Like in the Lego movie, that brings everyone together, a little bit of community spirit. And it'll be very nice.
I think you're sort of an extrovert introvert.
I think I am, yeah.
All right, have you got one last idea, Lauren?
I do. And I know it's kind of already sort of a thing, but I want to make it more of a thing. I think young people need to get more involved with politics, and that would make the world a better place.
Now, you say this as a young person.
I say this as a young person, a certified
From
young
one
person.
Young person to another.
Yeah.
I think the problem is...
She laughed, actually. And she wasn't laughing with you, actually.
No, I think she was.
Yeah. No, she's laughing
she was.
At you, actually.
Yeah, it's too confusing, and it's not accessible enough, so we need to think, how can we get politics to young people? Young people love Love Island. I love Love Island, and I get so behind... people on reality TV shows that think we need to sneak politicians like into Love Island, into The Circle, and then people will find themselves getting really like behind these people and not realising that they're learning about politics.
Well, it's funny you should say that because I was listening to The Archers on the way here and Brian and David are going to a seminar on the opportunities and challenges of Brexit. So there you go.
Yeah.
So when people say... Ed, if you were to do I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, you would have a wider audience than you'd ever have, and you could be able to get your message across to the electorate. What's your excuse for not doing it? Or what's your reason? Why is that a nonsense? I mean,
don't want to
we
eat
all know.
Insects.
Right. So not eating insects is more important than getting your message across to the electorate.
And that's the thing.
Could I go on with like a sort of PowerPoint presentation on the universal basic income? You know
can
what I mean?
Can everyone gather around the pool, please?
15 slides. What do you think, Jeff?
I'm just trying to get the young people engaged in politics.
What's the option? So I'm a Celebrity.
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah. Strictly has been done.
Strictly's been done. Big Brothers doesn't exist.
Mm.
Love Island.
Yeah.
It seems like that's your option, Ed.
Well, I'm not going on Love Island.
Okay.
I can officially announce
it. We tried.
Damn it.
We
tried so hard.
Yeah.
But I don't mind doing a cameo PowerPoint presentation.
Could be like a weekly challenge. Well, Miliband Mondays.
Yeah. Exactly. If they lose the challenge, they get to watch that. Lauren, if people want to come and see you, how can they find out about this tour that you've decided to undertake yourself, including public transport, logistics, and so on?
You can probably find me on a train in the quiet coach. Yeah.
The introvert coach.
But if you follow me on Twitter at Lauren Patterson, then I post everything on there.
Lauren, thanks so much.
Thank you. Cheers.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're in the outro. I know what I want for Christmas, by the way.
Oh, go on.
So this man called Mr. Alhuizen, I think that's how you pronounce his name, has published a book about words that are going out of fashion. So words that are sort of disappearing from the English language. And sort of remarkably or not remarkably, they seem to be mostly words that I use. I'll just give you a little sample. Lickspittle, definitely one of mine.
Really?
Gadzooks.
Gadzooks sounds like one of yours.
Definitely one of mine. Pettifogging, nincompoop, rumpus. I mean, I think they're all words that I would definitely use. I don't know whether crumbs is going out of fashion.
Crikey, diddly-doo, waffle-a-rooney.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm obviously sort of part of planned obsolescence.
You're preserving these words for future generations.
Do you think that's right?
Yeah, I think that's the way to frame it, think about it.
That's my role in life. Yes. But anyway, so that's my bid for a Christmas present. What would you like for Christmas? World peace.
I'd like a recording of you saying all these words for posterity so that they're not lost. We could do a Reason to be Cheerful time capsule, you know, like they did on Blue Peter, where they buried one. We could bury something in my back garden all your strange words and mannerisms.
True. Ceremonial.
Yes.
That's not a bad idea. Should we do our thank yous?
Yes.
So I'd like to thank Sivan Dorisamy, Anna Yearley and Maya Foa.
And thanks to Lauren Patterson, who you can find on Twitter and in the nation's comedy nights up and down the country. Emma Corsham produced our podcast. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made the idents. Ed Seed composed the music. And the artwork.
Emily Power!
So he's been Mr. Waffly Rooney.
He's been Mr. Diddly Doo at the Leisure Centre.
These have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.